Brennan, Barack Obama's handler in the CIA since Obama emerged in national politics by winning a Senate seat in Illinois in 2006, began placing Trump and his aides under extensive electronic surveillance in an attempt to derail Trump's candidacy. As WikiLeaks prepared to publish the emails of top Democratic National Committee, DNC officials, including Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, leaked from within the DNC, Brennan championed the Russian collusion narrative, seeking to delegitimize the Trump campaign. After the election, the CIA conspired with Democrats in Congress and the mainstream media to have Robert Mueller appointed as special counsel. Mueller was widely known in Washington as a former FBI director and a partisan deep state operative with close ties to FBI Director James Comey. As special counselor, Mueller had one mission, namely, to develop the information needed to accuse Trump of rigging the election with Russia's assistance. The plan called for Democrats in Congress to beat the mainstream media drum until Trump resigned or stepped aside for Vice President Mike Pence. Should the deep state fail to remove Trump from office through impeachment or a charge under the 25th Amendment that he is mentally incompetent, executive action, a CIA plan to assassinate Trump, is the deep state's last resort. The point is, unless Trump can be made to abandon his America First agenda, the globalists in the deep state have already decided that Trump must be removed from the presidency, one way or the other. The military-industrial complex. The first vignette involves a warning that President Dwight D. Eisenhower issued to America upon leaving the White House after 8 years as president. On January 17, 1961, President Eisenhower delivered his farewell speech to the nation in a televised address broadcast from the Oval Office. In that speech, Eisenhower sounded an alarm to future generations of Americans. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex, Eisenhower warned. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. He continued with a sentiment that is less frequently repeated. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes, he stressed. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. The Shadow Government. CIA whistleblower Kevin Shipp, a decorated CIA intelligence officer, has identified the CIA as the central node of the shadow government that controls all of the other 16 intelligence agencies, despite the existence of the Director of National Intelligence. According to Shipp, the deep state is composed of the military-industrial complex and its lobbyists, intelligence contractors, defense contractors, Wall Street through offshore accounts, the Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, the World Treasury Department, foreign lobbyists, and central banks. To this list, we can reinsert Congress, the group President Eisenhower knew votes to fund and protect the deep state's massive, largely unchecked clandestine operations. Shipp claims the CIA controls defense and intelligence contractors, can manipulate the president and presidential decisions, has the power to start wars, torture, initiate coups, and commit false flag attacks. Peter Dale Scott has come to view the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, the 1980 October surprise involving the release of the U.S. Embassy hostages in the Iran-Contra affair, and 9/11 as deep state events that repeatedly have involved lawbreaking and or violence, have been mysterious to begin with, and whose mystery has been compounded by systematic falsifications in media and internal government records. Scott has come to see these incidents as flowing in part from the sociodynamic processes of violent power itself, power associated with and deployed in the service of the global expansion of American military might. Focusing on what he has called the American war machine, Scott has advanced the understanding of the extent to which Eisenhower's military-industrial complex has led to the operation of an extra-constitutional deep state, willing to use the black political arts of false flag attacks, funding of mainstream media propaganda, and even assassination of heads of state to dominate U.S. politics by controlling both political parties. Obama administration illegally unmasks and leaks. The volume of mainstream media stories attributed to anonymous sources that were published during the 2016 presidential election caused Senator Charles Grassley, Republican Iowa, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Representative Devin Nunes, Republican California, the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, to become suspicious. Where did the Democrats get their information that Trump officials had conspired or otherwise colluded with Russia? Or even more specifically, unless the Obama administration had unmasked Trump campaign officials captured in NSA surveillance of foreign nationals, how did it begin to suspect that Trump officials were actively conspiring with Russian officials? Unmasking involves identifying the U.S. citizens captured in FISA-authorized electronic surveillance of foreign nationals, a process that invites abuse when government officials decide to make the unmasked U.S. citizens the targets of future surveillance. In other words, Obama officials appear to have done just this to get the dirt they needed on Trump officials to construct the Russian collusion narrative. Then, once in possession of the unmasked names, highly placed officials within the Obama administration appear to have committed a second crime by leaking to the press the highly classified information obtained on Trump campaign officials through the NSA Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court-ordered electronic surveillance. Investigating the issue, Grassley and Nunes became convinced that the FBI and NSA went one step further, deciding to place foreign nationals believed to be in touch with Trump campaign officials under electronic surveillance, with the intent of capturing Trump campaign officials in communication with the targeted foreign nationals. Even if the FBI or the DOJ were not interested in investigating the foreign nationals, the Obama administration appears to have instructed the NSA to find a way to conduct surveillance on the foreign nationals because the Obama administration wanted to capture Trump campaign officials in conversations with Russian nationals or with foreign operatives that were working with Russian nationals. Suspicion that unmasking had occurred quickly centered on Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and CIA Director John Brennan. The question was this: had President Obama instructed or otherwise allowed Rice, Power, and Brennan to unmask Trump campaign officials captured in NSA surveillance of foreign targets in order to develop information that Trump campaign officials were conspiring or otherwise colluding with Russian officials to rig the presidential election? It appears that once NSA electronic surveillance had captured intelligence appearing to link Trump campaign officials to Russian nationals, the Obama administration next illegally leaked that information to friendly reporters in the mainstream media. This would account for the number of reports accusing Trump campaign officials of colluding with the Russians that the mainstream media attributed to unnamed individuals close to the investigation. Within the White House, suspicion extended to former Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes as a lead culprit in leaking to the press the evidence of Russian collusion found after Rice, Power, and Brennan unmasked Trump campaign officials captured in NSA electronic surveillance of foreign nationals. On September 19, 2017, CNN reported that Rice admitted to House Intelligence Committee members that she had unmasked the identities of senior Trump officials to understand why the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, was in New York in 2016. Months earlier, on April 5, 2017, President Trump told reporters that Rice may have committed a crime by seeking to learn the identities of Trump associates swept up in surveillance of foreign officials by U.S. spy agencies. "I think the Susan Rice thing is a massive story," Trump told reporters in the Oval Office. "It's a bigger story than you know. The Russia story is a total hoax. There has been absolutely nothing coming out of that. What's happened is terrible. I've never seen people so indignant, including many Democrats who are friends of mine. Rice attempted to explain that she asked for the unmasking because Zayed had scheduled a trip to the United States without notifying the Obama administration about travel plans. However, it's more likely that Rice was suspicious that General Mike Flynn, Jared Kushner, and Steve Bannon had discussed opening a back channel to Russia in their 3-hour discussion that focused on Iran, Yemen, and the Middle East peace process. Representative Nunes, in a letter to Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats in July 2017, made clear his concern that all Obama administration leaks of classified information would be vigorously prosecuted. Nunes also alleged in a letter that Obama-era officials sought the identities of Trump transition officials within intelligence reports. Nunes's concern was that the Obama administration, since before the November 2016 election, had actively conspired to build the Russian collusion case against Trump through a process of unmasking intelligence reports and leaking the contents to partisan Clinton-supporting reporters in the mainstream media. These suspicions had a basis in fact, given the record of Obama Department of Justice under both Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, seeking to prosecute and convict political opponents in the press by orchestrating a campaign to leak secret grand jury information to reporters. This practice demanded the Obama administration FBI's active complicity in leaking secret grand jury administrations under both FBI directors Robert Mueller and James Comey. Mueller illegally leaks unmasked political intel. That the mainstream media built the case that Trump had colluded with Russia on a mountain of leaks is clear by examining any of a large number of stories that were informed only by anonymous sources and unnamed insiders. On May 27, 2017, for instance, the New York Times published an article titled "Top Russian Officials Discussed How to Influence Trump Aides Last Summer." The first paragraph of the article reads as follows. American spies collected information last summer revealing that senior Russian intelligence and political officials were discussing how to exert influence over Donald J. Trump through his advisors, according to three current and former American officials familiar with the investigation. None of these sources were named or otherwise identified in the article. Still, New York Times reporters did not hesitate to write that the unnamed Russians focused on Paul Manafort, identified as Trump campaign chairman at the time, and General Michael Flynn, identified as a retired general who was advising Mr. Trump. The article insinuated in print that both Manafort and Flynn had indirect ties to Russian officials, who appeared confident that each could help shape Mr. Trump's opinions on Russia. So in summary, the Times article claimed as sources three current and former American officials familiar with the investigation, all unnamed, who said unnamed Russian officials who felt they could influence Trump were involved in undocumented conversations with Manafort and Flynn. Finally, the New York Times referenced that intelligence was among the clues, which included information about direct communications between Mr. Trump's advisors and American officials that American officials received last year as they began investigating Russian attempts to disrupt the election and whether any of Mr. Trump's associates were assisting Moscow in the effort. These examples clearly suggest that Obama administration officials had leaked to the New York Times information obtained illegally by unmasking Trump campaign officials so as to obtain conversations and/or emails with them that the NSA obtained through electronic surveillance of foreign nationals. No wonder Grassley and Nunes were suspicious. Perhaps Mueller's two most blatant leaks were evident first in a New York Times story published on September 18, 2017, titled, "With a Picked Lock and a Threatened Indictment, Mueller's Inquiry Sets a Tone." In the article, reporters Sharon Lafreniere, Matt Apuzzo, and Adam Goldman made public that Mueller intended to follow his pre-dawn Gestapo-like raid into Manafort's Alexandria, Virginia apartment home with an indictment, according to information the newspaper reported learning from typically anonymous sources identified only as two people close to the investigation. Then, On Friday, October 27, 2017, Mueller obtained his first indictments in the Russian collusion case from a Washington, D.C. grand jury. Yet instead of making the charges public, Mueller had the grand jury seal the indictments until the following Monday, allowing the special counselor's office to leak the news to CNN. This gave Mueller the weekend, including the Sunday morning news programs, to allow Clinton operatives to build the case on television that Manafort, Flynn, and whoever else Mueller had indicted were guilty as charged. Through the weekend, the uncertainty among Trump supporters was heightened by their inability to identify exactly which suspects Mueller had indicted. Mueller should be forced to explain why he should be allowed to continue his investigation when a pattern of illegal unmasking and illegal leaking of classified information reaches beyond him to include the highest levels of the Obama administration. Proof abounded that Mueller's Russia probe was riddled with systematic government impropriety that would not only justify his firing and disqualify his Russian collusion investigation from being allowed to continue, but also demand a criminal investigation of Mueller himself and of the Obama administration officials involved in the illegal unmasking and illegal leaking. The question is whether Donald Trump is capable, with the support of U.S. patriots, of defeating the deep state, or whether the deep state has advanced to the point where it will crush the last vestiges of the Tea Party movement by removing Donald Trump from office. The deep state will not care if Trump is impeached, declared mentally incompetent, or, as a final resort, assassinated, as long as he is removed from office before the completion of his first term. Chapter 4. The strategy to block Trump's inauguration fails. Our source is not a state party. Julian Assange, on the source of the email leaks, December 2016. When the votes were counted on Election Day 2016, Trump won the Electoral College vote, but Hillary won the popular vote. That was enough to encourage diehard Hillary supporters to think that there yet may be a way to deny Trump the victory. Maybe one or more strategic recounts could tip the Electoral College vote to Hillary. Or maybe enough electors could be convinced that Trump was unfit to give Hillary the 270 electoral votes needed for victory. Protests began almost immediately, with thousands of people marching on Trump Tower the day after the election. Protests continued in the days following the election as demonstrators took to the streets holding signs that said, "Not my president," the hashtag Never Trump rally cry, while deep state operatives behind the scenes devised strategies that might block Trump from being inaugurated. In the weeks between Election Day on November 8, 2016, and Inauguration Day on January 20, 2017, the deep state, together with Democratic Party operatives, dared to imagine that if Trump could be prevented from taking the oath of office, Hillary Clinton may yet be president. Riots in the streets. On November 10, 2016, Trump tweeted, "Just had a very open and successful presidential election. Now professional protesters, incited by the media, are protesting. Very unfair." On November 11, 2016, the Associated Press reported that Portland, Oregon was the epicenter of the anti-Trump riots spreading across the country, with some 4,000 protesters marching in Portland's downtown area, smashing windows, and chanting, "We reject the president-elect." As midnight approached, Portland police pushed back against the crowd, arresting 26 demonstrators as protesters threw rocks at them. Similar gatherings occurred throughout the United States. In Denver, protesters managed to briefly shut down Interstate 25 as demonstrators made their way onto the freeway. Traffic was halted in the northbound and southbound lanes for about 30 minutes. Protesters also briefly shut down interstate highways in Minneapolis and Los Angeles. In San Francisco, high-spirited high school students marched through downtown chanting, "Not my president," and holding signs urging a Donald Trump eviction. Protesters waved rainbow banners and Mexican flags as bystanders high-fived the marchers from the sidelines. In New York City, a large group of demonstrators gathered outside Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, chanting angry slogans and waving banners bearing anti-Trump messages. In Philadelphia, protesters near City Hall held signs bearing slogans like, "Not our president," "Trans against Trump," and Make America Safe for All. 3 days after the election, the Washington Post reported that some 225 people had been arrested in anti-Trump protests, with at least 185 arrested in Los Angeles alone. To Hillary's consternation, many of the people protesting in the streets had not even bothered to vote in the election. NBC's KGW in Portland, Oregon, reported that most of the 112 protesters arrested in that city did not vote in Oregon, according to state election records, with 79 of the demonstrators arrested either not registered to vote in the state or not recorded as having turned in a ballot. An analysis conducted by the Oregonian newspaper in Portland, investigating those arrested in anti-Trump demonstrations who did not vote, revealed that at least one-third were out-of-state college students not eligible to vote in Oregon. Meanwhile, the conservative blogger known as the Gateway Pundit found proof that George Soros, the billionaire currency trader and investor, whose Open Society Foundation is notorious for funding left-wing progressive causes, had funded anti-Trump leftist groups who were advertising on the internet to hire demonstrators in various cities across the United States. Hillary blames Russia. On December 15, 2016, Hillary made a speech in New York to donors who the New York Times reported had collectively contributed roughly $1 billion to her 2016 presidential campaign, again blaming her defeat on a long-running strategy implemented by Russian President Vladimir Putin to discredit the fundamental tenets of American democracy. Vladimir Putin himself directed the covert cyber attacks against our electoral system, against our democracy, apparently because he has a personal beef against me, Clinton said. He is determined not only to score a point against me, but also undermine our democracy. Clinton acted as if Trump's collusion with Russia and WikiLeaks was a proven fact. This is part of a long-drawn strategy to cause us to doubt ourselves and to create the circumstances in which Americans either wittingly or unwittingly will begin to cede their freedoms to a much more powerful state, Clinton insisted. This is an attack on our country. What's important to remember here is that while WikiLeaks did obtain emails from the DNC and from Podesta, it has never been proven, in either case, that the Russians themselves hacked the DNC, nor has it been proven that WikiLeaks was working with the Russians. On December 16, 2016, Assange made another public appearance in an interview conducted by Sean Hannity that was first broadcast on Hannity's national radio show and subsequently broadcast that night on Hannity's Fox News television show. Assange made clear that Russia did not provide the Podesta emails or the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. He insisted the source of the email leaks was not a state party, denying that they came from any government. We're unhappy that we felt that we needed to even say that it wasn't a state party, he said. Finally, Assange pushed back against Hillary's accusations. Normally, we say nothing at all, Assange told Hannity. We have a conflict of interests. We have an excellent reputation, a strong interest in protecting our sources, and so we never say anything about them, never ruling anyone in or anyone out. Sometimes we do it, but we don't like to do it. We have another interest here that is maximizing the impact of our publications. So in order to protect a distraction attack against our publications, we've had to come out and say, no, it's not a state party. Stop trying to distract in that way and pay attention to the content of the publication. When Hannity suggested that the leak came from a disgruntled source within the DNC, possibly even within Podesta's office, Assange sidestepped, refusing to answer the question, in direct contrast to the way in which he vociferously denied that the source was Russia. Yet on December 18, 2016, 10 days after the election, Podesta repeated the Russia collusion theory in an interview conducted by host Chuck Todd on NBC's Sunday morning show Meet the Press. In response to Todd's direct questions, Podesta insisted the presidential election had been distorted by the Russian intervention. Asked if the election was a free and fair election, Podesta railed against Putin. I think the Russians clearly intervened in the election, and, now we know that, the CIA, the Director of National Intelligence, and the FBI all agree that the Russians intervened to help Trump, and that, as they have noted this week, NBC first revealed that Vladimir Putin was personally involved with that, he insisted. Pressed by Todd to directly answer whether the election was free and fair, Podesta accused Russia of wanting Hillary Clinton to lose. A foreign adversary directly intervened in our democratic institution and tried to tilt the election to Donald Trump. I think that if you look back and see what happened over the course of the last few weeks, you see the way the votes broke, you know, Podesta replied. I was highly critical of the way the FBI, particularly the FBI director, managed the situation with respect to the Russian engagement versus Hillary Clinton's emails. Republican defenders of Trump pushed back against Hillary and Podesta, suggesting that the Russian collusion narrative was a Democratic Party invention that was being disseminated by the deep state. Then, on December 18, 2016, Representative Peter King, Republican New York, a member of the House intelligence community, pushed back against the Russian collusion meme. King insisted that CIA Director Brennan was orchestrating a hit job against President-elect Donald Trump by leaking information suggesting Russia was behind the hacking of Podesta's emails to the press, despite having no evidence to prove the assertion. And that's what infuriates me about this. We have John Brennan, supposedly John Brennan, leaking to the Washington Post, to a biased newspaper like the New York Times, findings and conclusions that he's not telling the intelligence community, King said in an appearance on ABC's This Week Sunday show. It seems like, to me, there should be an investigation with what the Russians did, but also an investigation of John Brennan and the hit job he seems to be orchestrating against the president-elect, he insisted. Though unconfirmed, reports circulated that the Obama administration's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, held a meeting in his last days in office to float the idea of going to a Supreme Court justice to block Trump's inauguration on the premise that he only won because he colluded with Russia to hack Podesta emails that Russia leaked to WikiLeaks. Clapper discussed blocking the inauguration on the grounds that Trump was an illegitimate president due to alleged Russian interference in the elections, Patrick Howley, a writer for BigLeaguePolitics.com, reported. Supposedly, a high-level member of the intelligence community who witnessed the meeting reported that Clapper discussed going to one of the three female Supreme Court justices to make the case that the alleged Russian interference could invalidate Trump's claim to the presidency. Hamilton electors urge Electoral College vote-switching scheme. Perhaps the most desperate last-ditch effort to block Trump from the White House was organized by a group of citizens calling themselves Hamilton electors. The scheme involved unearthing obscure arguments from the Federalist Papers in a twisted attempt to argue that the Electoral College was created to keep a scoundrel like Trump from becoming president. We honor Alexander Hamilton's vision that the Electoral College should, when necessary, act as a constitutional failsafe against those lacking the qualifications from becoming president, the Hamilton electors' website proclaimed. In 2016, we're dedicated to putting political parties aside and putting America first. Electors have already come forward, calling upon other electors from both red and blue states to unite behind a responsible Republican candidate for the good of the nation. The goal of the Hamilton electors was to convince enough of the 538 members of the Electoral College scheduled to meet in their state capitals on December 19, 2016, to switch their votes to prevent Trump from getting the 270 electoral votes needed to be elected president. As freelance journalist Lily O'Donnell pointed out in an article published on November 21, 2016 in The Atlantic, Michael Back of Colorado and Brett Schifalo of Washington State were the two Democratic electors who called themselves Hamilton electors. The two Democrats formed the Hamilton electors in the hope of creating a national movement aimed at throwing the 2016 election into the House of Representatives. Still, given that Republicans controlled the House in 2016, the most the Hamilton electors could have hoped to accomplish would have been to delegitimize Trump's victory by getting enough electors to switch their votes. Baca and Schifalo argued that Alexander Hamilton was right in Federalist Paper No. 68, in which he wrote that the Electoral College was deemed necessary because choosing a president by popular vote would give the most populated states, like New York and California today, an unfair advantage that would fail to account for the choices of lesser populated states. The Hamilton electors hoped to emphasize Hamilton's argument that the office of president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. The point was that Trump should be denied the victory because he lacked the moral qualifications to be president, a fact the Hamilton electors thought had been affirmed by Hillary winning the popular vote. To be successful, the Hamilton electors would have had to convince 37 electors committed to voting for Trump to vote for someone else, a nearly impossible feat to accomplish. As the Hamilton electors' plan gained publicity in the mainstream media, the electors in Colorado and Washington State began to promote the idea that renegade electors should vote for a moderate Republican candidate, such as Republican Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Kasich, a former GOP presidential candidate, sat out the Republican National Convention in Cleveland as an expression of his opposition to Trump. In their best-case scenario, the Hamilton electors dreamed of uniting 135 Republican and 135 Democratic electors behind Kasich, thus securing the presidency for a moderate Republican. In their fallback strategy, the Hamilton electors plotted to convince 37 of the Republican electors in states that voted for Trump to switch their votes to Kasich, throwing the election into the House of Representatives. Their thought was that the GOP leadership in the House might be willing to twist the arms of Republican House members to vote for Kasich instead of Trump, a strategy designed to secure the presidency for the GOP while at the same time dumping Trump. As December 19th approached, the day set for the electors to meet in their various state capitals, Republican members of the Electoral College faced intense pressure, including personal harassment and death threats, as pro-Hillary and anti-Trump forces combined in their desperate attempt to keep Trump out of the White House. The bullying from the Trump haters was nearly overwhelming, with some electors receiving as many as 50,000 emails in the run-up to December 19th, clogging their electronic devices with unwanted anti-Trump venom. Before the electors met to vote, a Harvard University group backed by constitutional law professor Lawrence Lessig got into the act, offering free legal advice to electors deciding to change their votes. Despite all the media hoopla, the Block Trump Electoral College scheme was as dismal a failure as Jill Stein's ill-conceived recount maneuver. In the end, Trump received 304 electoral votes to Clinton's 227, two fewer than he earned on November the 8th, with more electors going rogue and defecting from Clinton than defecting from Trump. Chapter 5. Democrats Go Hard Left. Instead of seeking support from the center of the political spectrum, the Democratic Party has moved ever leftward, embracing positions that leave millions of Americans feeling left out. Eric Reimer, December 2017. When the move to deny Trump an Electoral College victory failed, Democrats and their supporters turned their attention away from the Clintons, resolving not just to resist Trump, but to complete the hard-left takeover of the Democratic Party. They now wanted to set the stage for gaining a leftist majority to retake Congress in 2018 in the quest to find another Obama-like charismatic radical to retake the White House in 2020. Once Trump was inaugurated, the Democrats' goal shifted to impeaching Trump, removing him from office by invoking the 25th Amendment, or forcing him to resign, with Pence then becoming president. In fact, Democrats were calling for Trump's impeachment even before he was inaugurated. Dozens of Democratic lawmakers refused to attend his inauguration. The Trump presidency was under siege almost immediately after he took the oath, setting the stage for the deep state strategy that would not give Trump a moment to breathe. The Democrats eyed a repeat of Jimmy Carter's defeat of Gerald Ford in 1976, following Nixon's resignation on August 9, 1974, when Nixon preferred resignation to almost certain impeachment and removal from office over Watergate. Blowing up the White House. Protesting Donald Trump's presidency, famed singer Madonna gave a profanity-laced address in Washington, D.C. on January 21, 2017, to a Women's March crowd estimated at 500,000 strong, a number various mainstream media reports argued was twice the number that had attended Trump's inauguration the day before. Yes, I'm angry. Yes, I'm outraged, Madonna said, expressing her dismay at what the mainstream media accounts described as the shocking Electoral College win of minority President Donald Trump. Women in the protest march wore pink pussy hats, knitted to display prominent feline ears. The hats symbolized opposition to a conversation recorded on a bus between Trump and Billy Bush, then host of Access Hollywood. A recording of that conversation was leaked to the Washington Post and published on Friday, October 7, 2016, 2 days before the second presidential debate. In that conversation, which Trump did not suspect was being recorded, Trump can be heard boasting in terms crude, even in a locker room, about grabbing women by their sexual organs. Predictably, the mainstream media discounted Trump's apology as well as his counterargument. While his words were foolish and inappropriate, Bill Clinton lost his law license for much worse, namely for lying about sexual advances he made toward Paula Jones, then an Arkansas State employee, when Clinton was governor of Arkansas. The height of Madonna's protest speech came when she cautioned that women would face a new age of tyranny under President Trump, adding the following incendiary language. Yes, I've thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House, but I know this won't change anything. We cannot fall into despair. Madonna attempted to explain away her obvious threat to the president by placing her protests in the context of love. Welcome the revolution of love, she said, to the rebellion, to our refusal as women to accept this new age of tyranny. We're not just women in danger, but all marginalized people. Responding to the estimated 5 million that took part in the 2017 Women's March protest nationwide, President Trump tweeted, "Watched protests yesterday, but was under the impression that we just had an election. Why didn't these people vote? Celebs hurt cause badly." Despite making women's issues the centerpiece of her campaign, Hillary Clinton lost the votes of white women overall and struggled to win the votes of women without a college education in swing states, including Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, all states President Obama won in 2008 and 2012. The real importance of the 2017 Women's March was that it signaled the degree to which the base of the Democratic Party was moving toward the far left. The pussy protesters in the nation's streets after the election were radical feminists, new feminists of the hard left, who were angry not only about the economic inequality of women, but about the white male privilege they believe is at the core of American capitalist oppression. The women Hillary needed for victory might have voted for Bernie Sanders, but they were not impressed by Hillary Clinton. For these radical feminists, Clinton was a part of the past, a past dominated by too many six-figure fees paid to her by Goldman Sachs for her Wall Street speeches, a past tarnished by Clinton Foundation financial scandals and pay-to-play allegations. Hillary's past was truly ridden with scandal. She could not explain why Ambassador Chris Stevens had died at Benghazi, or why she had refused to use the secure email devices provided by the State Department that were required to comply with national security laws. Truthfully, there was much in Hillary's past that remained questionable and difficult to explain, from her being fired as a Watergate attorney to her role in Whitewater, or from the death of Vincent Foster to the fact that Hillary's billing file from the Rose Law Firm was found squirreled away in a closet in the White House private residence. Add to this her husband's sexual escapades, plus a dozen other scandals that had plagued Hillary's career since she first stepped onto the public stage. With Hillary's loss to Trump, the hard left had only one objective, and Madonna captured it particularly well: blow up the White House. While Madonna's supporters insisted that she did not mean this threat literally, Madonna's inability to accept Donald Trump as president triggered the hard left's determination to impair his presidency with incessant resistance and obstruction. Crooked Hillary might have lost the election, but the hard left's vision of completing Obama's fundamental transformation of America had only just begun. Now with Hillary, a two-time loser in presidential elections, Democrats could promote candidates from within the party's hard left ranks who supported the radical left's agenda on issues ranging from open borders to same-sex marriage, and tilting foreign policy to favor Islam over Israel. Democratic National Committee chooses new leadership. On February 25, 2017, the Democratic National Committee chose an Obama administration insider, former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, to be DNC chair, tasked with rebuilding the Democratic National Party after Hillary Clinton's devastating loss. Perez has the type of radical activist past that appeals to the Bill Ayers hard-left wing of the Democratic Party. From 1995 to 2000, Perez served on the board of CASA of Maryland, an Hispanic advocacy group also affiliated with the radical national organization La Raza, the open borders group that has for generations led the charge for illegal immigrants to be granted amnesty. George Soros, Tom Perez, and the politics of chaos. Taking a page from the race riots and the violent Vietnam War protests of the 1960s and early 1970s, hard-left billionaire George Soros appeared determined to escalate his campaign to destroy America by openly funding the politics of chaos. On August 14, 2015, The Washington Times documented that Soros had funded, to the tune of some $33 million, the leftist groups that ignited violent riots in Ferguson, Missouri, a year earlier, with activists bused to Ferguson by a host of far-left groups funded by Soros in Chicago, New York, and Washington. With the decision of the Democratic National Party on February 25, 2017, to appoint Perez, an Obama administration official who has served both in the leadership of the DOJ's Civil Rights Division and as Secretary of Labor as its new chair, Soros and his Open Society Foundation were positioned to advance Obama's implementation of the Saul Alinsky strategy, designed to rub raw social tensions over race, immigration, and discrimination. Soros and Perez have had a considerable history together. On May 15 and 16, 2014, Soros's Open Society hosted then-Secretary of Labor Perez at its board meeting in New York City. Among the questions for Perez recommended by the staff of Soros's Open Society Foundation were these. What is Department of Labor's role in the implementation of DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and the intersection of DACA and workforce development issues? What can be done to ensure full implementation of DACA? DACA was the program President Obama established by executive order that allowed children who entered the United States illegally before 2007, while they were yet less than 16 years old, to receive a 2-year period of deferred action and deportation and a green card permit to work, provided they were enrolled in school, or honorably discharged from the military and had no criminal record. On June 23, 2016, the Supreme Court deadlocked in a 4-4 tie, leaving in place an appeals court record that blocked the Obama administration from making DACA permanent and expanding the DACA privileges to parents of DACA-eligible youths. On September 5, 2017, President Trump ended the DACA program by executive order, urging Congress to pass a replacement before ordering DACA to phase out all protections in 6 months. Perez's reaction to Trump's decision was expectedly angry. Donald Trump has secured his legacy as a champion for cruelty, Perez said. First, he took away protections for immigrant parents. Now he's going after the children. Rescinding DACA is the latest tactic in the Republican playbook to promote hate and discrimination. Democrats radicalized by Senator George McGovern's anti-war agenda in 1968, however, were the precursors for a Democratic Party today willing to unleash violent anarchists to advance their hard-left agenda. For decades, Soros has been behind the move to shift the Democratic Party from the liberal agenda of John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey of the 1960s to the hard-left revolutionary agenda of weather underground terrorist bomber Bill Ayers. In this radical transformation of the Democratic Party, Soros has been ready to pour hundreds of millions of dollars into training rabble-rousers and political operatives to transition away from the disciplined civil disobedience, civil rights marches led by Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s, to the anarchistic violence of the Occupy, Antifa, and Black Lives Matter movements that we experience today. Now with Perez and Ellison at the head of the DNC, Soros is positioned to transform the Democratic Party into an even more radical organization, one that prevents Trump-supporting members of Congress from holding peaceful town hall meetings, while anarchists marching in the streets break windows, block traffic, and shout obscenities. Chapter 6. The Deep State Sets a Trap. At a conference in mid-July, Barack Obama's CIA director John Brennan remarked that executive branch officials have an obligation to refuse to carry out outrageous or anti-democratic orders from President Donald Trump. Michael Crowley, Politico, September 2017. To remove Trump from the presidency, the deep state had no choice but to gain political control over the Justice Department. Should a Trump-appointed attorney general begin investigating Democrats in the Obama administration, the mainstream media promotion of the Russian collusion narrative would be derailed. With a Trump loyalist appointed as attorney general, the Department of Justice could turn the tables and begin investigating Hillary Clinton and John Podesta for the payments they received for selling U.S. military technology to Russia under Secretary Clinton's reset strategy. From there, the investigation could examine Secretary Clinton's role in the Clinton Foundation pay-to-play scandal with Canadian entrepreneur Frank Giustra that ended up with Russia owning some 20% of all U.S. uranium production. The appointment of Senator Jeff Sessions to the position of Attorney General proved a profound disappointment and setback for Trump when Sessions decided to recuse himself from the DOJ investigation into Russian election collusion with the Trump campaign. The moment Trump blew up against Sessions for recusing himself, Democratic Party leaders, including Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, went public, notifying Trump that his firing of Sessions would be sufficient to precipitate bringing impeachment charges against him in the House. With Trump blocked politically from firing Sessions, the deep state maneuvered to have Robert Mueller, a deep state operative who had served both Bush and the Obama administrations as the Attorney General from 2001 to 2013, appointed as special counsel. John Brennan, Obama's CIA handler, intervenes in election. New York Republican Representative Peter King, a member of the House intelligence community, was among the first to insist that CIA Director John Brennan was responsible for orchestrating a hit job against President-elect Donald Trump by going around the intelligence community and leaking information to the press, suggesting that Russia was behind the hack of Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. And that's what infuriates me about this, that we have John Brennan, supposedly John Brennan, leaking to the Washington Post, to a biased newspaper like the New York Times, findings and conclusions that he's not telling the intelligence community, King said in an appearance on ABC's This Week on December 18, 2016. It seems like to me that there should be an investigation with what the Russians did, but also an investigation of John Brennan and the hit job he seems to be orchestrating against the president-elect, King insisted. Since before the 2008 election, as noted earlier, Brennan appears to have been Barack Obama's CIA handler. In 2008, Obama was one of the three presidential candidates involved who had his passport file breached on three separate occasions, with the first occurring on January 9th, followed by separate violations on February 21st and March 14th. The New York Times noted that the two offending State Department contract employees who were fired had worked for Stanley Incorporated, a company based in Arlington, Virginia, while the reprimanded worker continued to be employed by the Analysis Corporation of McLean, Virginia. The newspaper gave no background on either corporation other than to note that Stanley Incorporated did computer work for the government. On March 22, 2008, the Washington Times reported that Obama's passport breach traced back to the Analysis Corporation of McLean, Virginia. John Brennan, a former CIA agent who was then serving as an advisor on intelligence and foreign policy to then-Senator Obama's presidential campaign, headed the Analysis Corporation. Although the State Department promised a full-scale investigation at the time, the public was kept in the dark. In July 2008, the State Department's Office of Inspector General issued a 104-page investigative report on the passport breach incidents involving the presidential candidates, stamped sensitive but unclassified, that was so heavily redacted as to be near worthless to the public. Investigative reporter Kenneth Timmerman claimed a well-placed but unnamed source told him that the real point of the passport breach incidents was to cauterize the Obama file, removing from it any information that could prove damaging to his eligibility to be president. According to this theory, the breaches of then-presidential candidate John McCain's and Hillary Clinton's files were done for misdirection purposes, to create confusion and to suggest that the motives of the perpetrators were attributable entirely to innocent curiosity. Brennan was brought into the White House as Deputy Security Advisor for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism before being appointed by President Obama to head the CIA in 2013. On February 13, 2010, in a speech to New York University School of Law students that the White House posted on YouTube, Brennan, then the assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, included a lengthy statement in Arabic that he did not translate for his English-speaking audience, noting that he was an undergraduate at the American University in Cairo in the 1970s. Brennan proceeded to use only the Arabic name Al-Quds when referring to Jerusalem. Brennan commented that during his 25 years in government, he spent considerable time in the Middle East as a political officer with the State Department and as a CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, I saw how our Saudi partners fulfilled their duty as custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina, he said. I marveled at the majesty of the Hajj and the devotion of those who fulfilled their duty as Muslims of making that pilgrimage. Brennan persisted in pushing the Russian collusion meme against the Trump campaign, even after various other heads of intelligence and law enforcement organizations with the federal government testified, often under oath, that there was no evidence to prove that contention. On May 8, 2017, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee under oath that he had not seen any evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. Only weeks earlier, Clapper told NBC News, "We did not include any evidence in our report, and I say our, that's NSA, FBI, and CIA, with my office, the Director of National Intelligence, that had anything that had any reflection of collusion between members of the Trump campaign and the Russians. There was no evidence of that included in our report." But when Representative Trey Gowdy grilled former CIA Director Brennan at a House Intelligence Committee hearing on May 23, 2017, if he had any hard evidence of collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russia, Brennan answered cryptically, "I don't do evidence." When Gowdy pressed Brennan that assessment is the intelligence tradecraft word for evidence, Brennan finally admitted that the CIA had no evidence of collusion, but he did so in a way that intentionally suggested there was a lot of smoke, even if no fire had been found. "I don't know whether or not such collusion, and that's your term, such collusion existed. I don't know. But I know that there was a sufficient basis of information and intelligence that required further investigation by the Bureau to determine whether or not U.S. persons were actively conspiring, colluding with Russian officials." Deep State Maneuvers to Appoint Special Counsel. On March 2, 2017, Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 elections after Democrats in Congress, led by House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, pressed that Sessions may not have fully disclosed in his confirmation hearings conversations with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. On May 9, 2017, President Trump fired James Comey as FBI director based on the recommendation of Attorney General Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein. "I cannot defend the director's handling of the conclusion of the investigation of Secretary Clinton's emails," Rosenstein wrote in a letter released by the White House. "And I do not understand his refusal to accept the nearly universal judgment that he was mistaken." Almost immediately, the deep state reacted with indignation, with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York charging that by firing Comey, Trump was attempting to cover up the Russia investigation. Comey and the FBI had just opened a grand jury investigation in Virginia that had issued subpoenas for records related to President Trump's decision to fire National Security Advisor Michael T. Flynn for misleading Vice President Mike Pence about the extent of his contacts with the Russian ambassador during the presidential transition. Then on May 17, 2017, 8 days after Trump fired Comey, Rosenstein, as acting attorney general, given Sessions' decision to recuse himself in the Russia investigation, appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller to serve as special counsel, charged with investigating any links and/or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of Donald J. Trump. Rosenstein's letter was so broad as to include any matter arising from the Russian collusion investigation. By firing Comey, Trump fell into a deep state plan engineered by Democratic Party operatives to put the president under an investigation with virtually unlimited scope, unlimited completion deadline, and unlimited funding. During the Clinton administration, Rosenstein joined the team of prosecutors working under independent counsel Kenneth W. Starr's investigation of Hillary and Bill Clinton's real estate holdings in the Whitewater affair, an investigation that concluded with no indictments being filed against the Clintons. Appointed in 2005 by President George W. Bush to be the U.S. Attorney for Maryland, Rosenstein was the only U.S. attorney appointed by Bush who was asked to stay on by President Obama during his 8-year term. Although furious at Sessions, Trump realized that the deep state had set a trap, pushing the Russia collusion narrative to the point where Sessions felt pressured to recuse himself. With Sessions removed from the Russia collusion investigation, Rosenstein, a long-term Department of Justice operative favorable to the Democrats, took the opportunity to appoint Robert Mueller, another long-term deep state operative, as special counselor. As special counselor, Mueller was in a position to bring criminal obstruction of justice charges against Trump for firing Comey, as well as charges that Trump had colluded with the Russians to win the election. Rosenstein, Comey, and Mueller all shared a history of working in the Department of Justice that traced back to the Clinton administration, with all three having worked on FBI investigations that ultimately resulted in exonerating the Clintons from any wrongdoing, a history that stretched back to Whitewater, the real estate fraud that involved Hillary and Bill Clinton when Bill was an Arkansas governor, and included, as we shall soon see, other Clinton scandals, such as the Mark Rich pardon. With Mueller appointed, the Democrats in Congress launched threats of impeachment if Trump should fire Sessions as a prelude to firing Mueller. Truthfully, the hiring and firing of the FBI director, the attorney general, and any independent prosecutor appointed, even one disguised by the more innocuous-sounding title of special counsel, are all within the authority of the president. Yet the deep state devised the mainstream media narrative such that Trump's firing Comey was construed as evidence that he was obstructing justice in the Russian collusion probe. The deep state, with the willing cooperation of the mainstream media, was willing to elevate that narrative to the impeachment level if Trump dared complete the job of protecting himself by firing not only Comey, but also Rosenstein, Sessions, and Mueller. James Comey, Robert Mueller, and Loretta Lynch, all Clinton fixers. As suggested previously, FBI Director James Comey is a Clinton fixer with a long history of running interference within the Department of Justice to make sure the Clintons are never prosecuted, a loyalty that the Clintons have repaid in corporate board appointments that have earned Comey millions of dollars. As noted earlier, Comey's involvement in protecting Hillary goes back to the mid-1990s and the Whitewater scandal. The same holds true for both Robert Mueller, who served as the head of the FBI from 2001 to 2013, and for Loretta Lynch, who served as the Attorney General from 2015 to 2017, the successor to Obama confidant Eric Holder. In January 2016, Judicial Watch released 246 pages of previously undisclosed internal memos obtained by a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA request from Ken Starr's office of the Independent Counsel investigation in 1998 that proved Department of Justice prosecutors had evidence that Hillary Clinton and her associate, Webb Hubbell, at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, Arkansas, were guilty of criminal fraud in the Whitewater real estate affair. In April 1995, Hickman Ewing, the chief deputy to Kenneth Starr, drafted an indictment of Hillary Clinton, alleging that she provided false information and withheld information.